Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show, online at edexcellence.net. Please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who never reads from a teleprompter, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, how you doing, babe?
I'm doing fine. How
you about know why you, that is?
Why is that?
Because AEI won't invest in the teleprompter. I keep saying, guys, I need a teleprompter. And they won't deliver.
See, I thought it was that you just say the same thing over and over and over again, so you need a teleprompter.
It works funny how that works.
So,
but by that light, the president shouldn't need one either.
Oh, well.
Zing.
Zing. Zing. You know, it's funny. We limit our answers on this show to 90 seconds or less. The president gives a press conference, and he goes on for paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs. Maybe we should, you know, up our game now that it's...
He speaks at length.
I know. It is okay to speak at length and to be intellectual and thoughtful. That's back in.
I'm not... You know, well, you remember Winston Churchill's line on this, right? He said that if you wanted him to speak for, you know, 2 hours, he could start right now. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted him to speak concisely for 5 minutes, he'd need 2 weeks to prepare.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that the fact that the president's long-winded, it necessarily proves that he's insightful or intellectual.
All right, well then, let's not be long-winded. We'll get started. We've got to play Pardon the Gadfly. We've got Rate That Reform, which is with a little special twist today. And of course, Amber's Research Minute. So let's get started, Christina, and play Pardon the Gadfly.
On Tuesday, Fordham released a new paper out about accountability in school voucher programs. We conclude that programs should adopt a sliding scale. The more voucher-bearing students a school enrolls, the greater the transparency and accountability it should face. Is that a fair compromise between letting the market rule on one hand and requiring private schools to participate in state testing, even if they serve just a handful of students with vouchers, on the other?
That for a leading question.
I apologize
question.
For the script.
Speaking of long-winded.
Mike, do you want to rephrase? Stina, you want to rephrase? What's the question here?
The question is this, Rick. Was this the best paper on school vouchers ever written in the history of the universe?
I do want to get Amber on the record here. I want to see what the research director of Fordham says about a research design, which is, let's ask 14 of our friends to email us some thoughts.
It was 20.
Yes, it was 20. And we weren't friends with all of them. And we did not call it a research paper. All right, this is a policy paper.
Well, no, Amber, you're saying this was on your week off? Amber was out of the office and it gets sneaked through.
It's a white paper.
Okay. All right. We did not claim this is a representative sample. All right, look, the big question in the voucher world is, you know, should kids participating in voucher programs have to take state tests or other kinds of tests? And if they do take those tests, do you make the test results public? Some people say, you know what, if a school is participating in the voucher school, all of its kids should have to take the state test, make those results public for transparency purposes. And so we're trying to find a good solution here. And as you heard from Christina, we came up with a sliding scale. So is this reasonable?
I mean, I think it is, right? I mean, part of the problem here is the way folks have planted the flags in the choice debate. You've got the choice absolutists who want to say, we're going to have a market, and a market, and frequently in their telling, is giving people public funds and then just assuming that these parents, who we don't always trust to make good choices about alcohol consumption or about safety or about employment or anything else, are going to be consistent and predictably good choosers on behalf of their kids, even when they don't have the information they need to make good choices. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you get the folks who say, choice can't work in education. It can work in almost anything else in life, but families are incompetent to make good choices on behalf of their kids. And, you know, what this suggests, you know, a sliding scale says, look, if you're going to enroll voucher kids, there's two things you got to do. One, there's got to be some basic parameters as to what it means to take public tax dollars and educate kids under a public program. And two, families making these decisions need to have access to information they need to make responsible choices on behalf of their kids. How constraining that should be is where people get hung up, and a sliding scale way of thinking about it at least says, look, if schools are only taking a couple kids in these programs, mm-hmm. it's a lot less important that we be prescriptive about the information available or the political economy than if these schools are taking a whole lot of these kids.
Yeah, and this is a big relevant question because right now in Ohio and in Wisconsin, Democratic governors have put forward proposals where basically all the kids in a participating private school would have to take the state test, and we suspect that will drive a lot of private schools out of the programs, which will reduce the number of choices and probably leave the programs with mostly schools that are either that have started up to take advantage of the vouchers, which happens in Milwaukee a lot, or Catholic schools or another religious schools that are desperate for the money, and you'll have fewer of these secular independent schools. So, all right, we agree. The sliding scale is the best idea to come out of the education policy community in many years. Thank you, Rick. I like that. Okay, Christina, second topic.
Let's keep talking about vouchers. Jay Matthews argues in his Washington Post column this week that, quote, this nation of public school backers just won't go for vouchers, unquote. Is he right?
So, Amber, what was Matthews' research design here more or less compelling than the Petrilli design? Mike?
Definitely less. So Jay Matthews says, look, he supports the program in Washington, D.C., the Opportunity Scholarship Program. He's been on the record for that. However, he sees that it's now under pressure. The Democrats have moved to kill it. There's some talk about trying to hold harmless the kids that are in the program. But he says, look, we should just give up, uncle, and no longer spend the political capital to keep it alive. That, look, people just... most people don't want to support private school vouchers. End of story.
What I didn't understand in Jay's argument was the $13 million a year he's freeing up and this political energy that is no longer being lashed into this futile program. I'm not sure how he anticipated what the logical process was by which this is going to make a bigger difference in DCPS or charters. Does Jay really think that this $13 million bucks is going to transform DCPS?
Right. No, I think that's right.
What's the benefit of giving up the fight?
But let's go to his core argument, which is that the country doesn't support vouchers, is never going to support vouchers. What do you think? 5 years from now, 10 years from now, do you think we're going to see a lot more voucher programs in lots more places?
No, I think it's up in the air. I mean, I think part of the problem is this is something we've talked about a number of times before. I don't know what the hell it means to support vouchers. It does. Vouchers are a label. It's like saying charter schools are good or charter schools are bad. Mm-hmm. Vouchers is simply the intuition, right? Friedman dusted it off 50 odd years ago, and Thomas Paine a century before that, that if we're going to spend public dollars to educate kids, that they don't have to run through big state bureaucracies. Mm-hmm. And I think American public is certainly capable of embracing that if it's designed smart and if it's designed right.
Okay, see, Rick was going there talking in Obama-style paragraphs and paragraphs.
You said this makes you sound smart. I was going for it.
Okay, Christina, topic number three.
Across the country, a new policy will allow students to identify themselves as multiracial, rather than requiring them to check one box for their race or ethnicity. Some researchers and advocacy groups think this will wreak havoc on efforts to track achievement gaps, racial segregation, and other issues over time. Are they right? Does it matter?
So this was in a Washington Post article, and folks like Gary Orfield at the Harvard Civil Rights Project are the ones that are most upset about this development because they've spent their whole careers tracking data, in a very prescribed way, and this is going to create some changes. Look, this is common sense to me. I mean, of course, a kid who is, half white, half black, or half black, half Hispanic, I mean, shouldn't have to choose one box over the other. They should be able to identify themselves as they, in their full manner. And if this messes up tracking achievement gaps and other things, I think that just points to kind of the silliness of being obsessed with these racial boxes. I mean, what does it mean in this sort of post-racial, Obama world to try to put people into these different labels?
I mean, right, this is the box we've gotten ourselves into by fixating on these racial distinctions. For instance, if by focusing on economic disparities, we could get much of these distinctions and track them without having to squeeze all of our children into racially identifiable categories.
Well said and succinctly, too. We'll leave it at that. Okay, that's all the time for Pardon the Gadfly. It is now time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, I don't want to make you nervous, but I understand that later in the show we're going to hear a new song for Rate That Reform. I don't know.
It's supposed to be jazzier than mine.
I'm wondering if I know your segment is very popular, but yep. I wonder if now that the Rate That Reform is kind of
but
upping the ante.
But I still have the song variety at the end, though.
So well, you do.
I try to spice it up.
You do. Okay, Amber, what are we talking about today?
We're talking about the new RAND study. It's getting quite a bit of attention. It's called Charter Schools in 8 States. First thing to know, it's really charter schools in 3 states and 5 large districts. But anyway,
bam.
It's a complex study with a strong strong quasi-experimental design that addresses some of the shortcomings of earlier charter impact studies. It asks four questions. I've got time to hit on two. First, what effect do charter schools have on test score gains for students who transfer between traditional schools and charter schools? The more reliable analyses were done at the non-elementary level, found that the gains for students attending charters were on par with the gains these same students experienced in traditional charter schools. So no better, no worse. However, the study took the analysis beyond test scores and examined other important student outcomes like graduation and college entry rates. In the two sites where available data, where there were available data, this is Florida and Chicago, they found students who attended a charter high school were more likely to graduate and enroll in college compared to those students who transitioned to a traditional high school. Little caveat, those charter students also attended a charter middle school. So, bottom line, tepid news about student gains in charters, good news about graduation and college entry rates.
She is succinct. She is tough.
She is.
You should and be Secretary of Smart.
I try to get in the little important, you know, methodological details.
Who was the lead
and that's just for your fans out there. I know.
Who was the lead researcher on this, Amber?
Brian Gill was one of the lead researchers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the question. Brian Gill mm-hmm. or Dan Goldhaber? Dinner? Drinks?
We are not revisiting that again. Just ignoring that. Can we talk about the study, please?
Okay.
It does, you know.
What's a non-elementary school, Ams?
Because they didn't have baseline data. You know, if you enter in at grade K, you know, you need baseline data for, mm-hmm. you know, transfers to.
But so it's non-elementary. Is that middle schools and high schools?
Yeah, middle schools, high schools.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
By the way, this is the same reason that the big federal evaluation of charter schools that's out there in the field somewhere, we're waiting for it to come out, is of middle schools. We took some heat for this from Education Next a while ago when this happened, not looking at elementary schools. But again, it's very hard and expensive to look at elementary schools if you're going to do a random assignment study.
But it is a problem because the disproportionate share of charters are elementary schools.
Well, so there is that. Now, could you say, I mean, is the picture uneven around the country? I mean, is this part of the story or does it look much the same?
I think we always say it's mixed, you know, but I think what was interesting about this study is that it really tried to address all the shortcomings. I mean, not all, but a lot of Hoxby brought up some of this, and I don't want to get too technical, but it's a fixed effect design, and she had a lot of problems with that, and they did some, all these analyses to try to correct for that. So, mm-hmm. You know, I just felt like it was pretty strong in terms of what they were able to say.
This was IES funded out?
You know, that wasn't clear. No. I don't think it
Gates,
was.
I think.
Yeah, I didn't see an IES anywhere.
And how should listeners reconcile this with the recent Tom Kane study of the charters in Massachusetts, where he did find a big effect?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're looking at, they didn't make the distinction in this study in terms of whether they were, you know, union-backed or non-union-backed. This was more of a gross measure, where the Kane study, I think, tried to make some nuanced discussions and arguments among the population of charter schools, mm-hmm. where this was just a charter school population.
Well, I'll tell you how I make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that charter schools in Massachusetts are a lot better than charter schools in most other places. You know, we see in Ohio, our home state, that most charter schools there stink. So, yeah. And that's what the findings were. And particularly some of these big cyber charters that are just terrible. So, you know, some states have gone about this better than others.
Mm-hmm.
That should be no surprise. Well,
yeah, I mean, and that was new stuff. That whole, I didn't have time to get into that, but that whole discussion of virtual charter schools, that was new ground to be looking at. So that was kind of cool.
All right, Amber. So what is the song?
The
that goes
song,
along with this one?
I tried to, you know, concentrate on the good news and the study, and that was the fact that the charter students are more likely to graduate and go on to college. They are simply the best. So we have that song with the same title by Tina Turner.
Well, you know, Amber, I have to say, I'm a little surprised you would go for that. I mean, it seems like that was overstating the findings.
Yeah, I know. It was
the best.
It was
better than all the rest.
It was between that and Eye of the Tiger, and I could not figure out how we could have made Eye of the Tiger.
Bloody Sunday in a disproportionate fashion a couple weeks back. I got to put this right there with
it. It's really, really tough. I mean, I'm telling you, sometimes we're just scratching our heads.
How many songs?
A little bit better than all the rest. Like that.
How many songs are in the publicly available catalog.
We're making our way quickly through them.
Maybe a couple hundred. Hey, we had the Leapfrog last week. I didn't like that either. So. Yeah.
Well, how about Mike's Frog song? Wouldn't that have been more suitable? Because they're kind of adolescent and not particularly great. Well, much like Mike's Frog song.
There's no song about, you know, charter schools.
Thank you very much, Amber. Yeah. Amber Winkler with her Research Minute. Now it is time for Rate That Reform.
Woo. See? Good wow. song,
that
right?
That is peppy.
Good energy.
That is peppy.
Good energy.
That is just going to keep, this keeps the show going strong all the way through.
I really chose it because I really enjoy watching the two of you dance. Mm-hmm. So
I know. Well, someday when we do video podcasts, we'll see. Okay, Stafford, what are we rating today?
Light it up, Doug.
Well, because it's March Madness, I decided I'd bring you a basketball story. It is a sad story, unfortunately, about the North Lawndale College Prep basketball team's loss to Champaign Centennial High School at the Illinois State High School semifinals by 1 point. Mm. But it wasn't their poor foul shots or wide three-pointers that caused their defeat. It was their uniforms. So what could I possibly mean by that? Well, the uniforms are clean, and they had the school's name on front and each player's number and last name on the back. But their decorative stripe was in the wrong place. Yes, that's right. Hmm. North Lawndale Prep lost the state basketball semifinal because the stripe on their jersey was in the wrong place. Hmm. So instead of having a 4-inch stripe that ran along the side of the jersey from armpit to hem, they had a stripe that ran around the armpit. And thus, NLCP was awarded a technical foul at the beginning of the game, and Champaign Centennial started with a 1-point lead. And the final score was 66-65.
Wow.
Very sad. So, the North Lawndale coach claims ignorance of the alleged rules about the uniforms, but a representative from the high school Illinois Association claims she told him of the violation repeatedly over 2 years. And according to the National Federation of Association, there are a lot of associations involved in this, the rules haven't changed for about 10 years. Anyway, all of this leads me to conclude that a big F goes to the coach of the North Lawndale College Prep. I know he's not really like the reformer, and this is Rate That Reform, but honestly, you're supposed to be a role model, big guy, and letting your players lose because you are too much of a deadbeat to read the rules about the uniforms, the PDF of which, I might add, is not only available online, but is explained by the National Federation rep as, quote, uniforms for dummies. I gave an A to the ref who wore the technical foul because I know the players lost, and that's very sad, but enough is enough. 2 years of warnings mean they need to change their uniforms. Rules are rules.
Wow, I did not expect Stafford to go in that direction with this
one. No.
I really thought she was going to go after these bureaucratic, ridiculous rules. Who, you know.
This is the new Fordham.
we are buckling down. You know, this is a nation of laws.
On vouchers, on uniforms. The new Fordham is the new Fordham, baby.
We're not messing around
if
anymore.
It's not regulated and there's not a rule, let's get one.
At the same time, like, the coach knew. He had to have known.
Well, here's so two things. One, if you lose on a technical foul because, you know, the guy, you know, chop blocks, a guard on the other team going in for a layup, that's a technical foul worth losing on. This seems kind of lame.
Yeah. And it is kind of lame.
And two, I mean, if he was doing this for 2 years, have they been giving him a technical foul every game for 2 years?
No. Apparently they've just never warned him about it. But
that's kind of weird that all of a sudden in the state semifinal, I think the fix was in. Yeah. And this seems like a vastly disproportionate number of adults and time and energy being spent worrying about uniform configuration.
Would this be an appropriate time to tell everybody that I am leading the Fordham office pool when it comes to March Madness? I just want to get that out there because this has never, ever before happened. In fact, I almost always come in dead last.
Just to clarify this for the listeners, how many NCAA games would you estimate you caught this last college season in preparation for this?
You mean before the March Madness?
Yes.
Well, I mean, there were a couple of now, I should say my son Nico, who is 17 months old, loves watching basketball. It turns out. And so there have been some times when we've sat down, he says, ball, ball, ball. And we sit down and we watch, you know, about 2 minutes of it.
Just
of a
an
game.
Estimate, Mike. How many games?
2 minutes. Mm.
2 minutes of how
Zero.
Many games?
Zero.
Okay. And yes, so this is impressive. This is especially impressive.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. You know, I have found that if you pay attention to some degree to the rankings of the teams going in, that you do better. So anyway, who wants to get my tips for next year, I'm happy to
This is called a chalk bracket.
Oh, my.
All right. Well, thank you, Stafford, for rating that reform. It was a nice break from just giving school districts a hard time for cutting their budgets in stupid ways. But you know what's going to come up very soon, I think, is we're going to get to have all kinds of fun with stupid ways that school districts are spending stimulus dollars. Mm-hmm. And so I look forward to
it. I look forward to that also.
I look forward to that as well. All right. And you can look forward to it as well, listeners out there. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hiss.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.